them sandwiches. Most of the people here have probably been sleeping in the central station or in the nearby multi-story car parks. Yuna no longer feels hungry. It's only there as a weight that makes his legs weak. When he's handed his coffee and sandwich, he feels like he's going to faint. He moves to one side, unwraps the bread, takes a bite, and swallows it, but his stomach starts to cramp, trying to reject the food. He puts his hand over his mouth and turns his back on the others. Dizziness forces him to his knees. He spills his coffee on the ground, takes another bite, coughs and spits it out, and feels sweat break out on his forehead. "How are you doing?" the Iranian man says, having seen what happened. "I haven't got round to eating anything for a while," he replies. "A busy man?" the Iranian smiles gently. "Yes," Yuna says, coughing again. "Just let me know if you need help." "Thanks, but I'm fine," Yuna mutters, then picks up his stick and limps away. "At 1 o'clock, the soup kitchen in St. Clara Church opens," the man calls after him. "Come along. You could do with sitting down and getting warm." Yuna crosses the bridge towards the city hall, feeds the sandwich to the swans, and walks with heavy steps up the long slope of Hanferkargatan. He stops and rests for a while outside Kungsholmen Gymnasium School, fingering the little stone in his pocket, and then carries on towards the fire station before turning off into Kruneberger Park. The foliage high above is drenched in sunlight, but the grass beneath the trees is shady, a soft moss green. Yuna walks slowly up the hill, leaning on his stick, loosens the wire inside the railings, opens the gate, and enters the old Jewish cemetery. "I'm sorry I look the way I do," he says, putting the stone down on Samuel Mendel's family grave. Yuna pushes a sweet wrapper away with his stick and tells his former partner that Jurek Walter is dead at last. Then he stands in silence, listening to the wind through the trees and the sound of the children in the nearby playground. "I've seen the evidence," he whispers, patting the headstone before he leaves. Margot Silverman has asked Yuna to attend an unofficial meeting today. She's probably just trying to be nice to him, letting him play at being a detective for a while. On his way down towards Flemingsgatan, Yuna thinks about the orgies Maria Carlsson attended. Saturnalias, carnivals, drunken binges, they have always been part of human life. Every breath takes us closer to death, and we console ourselves with work and routines. But every so often, we have to turn our regulated lives upside down, if only to prove to ourselves that we are free. Maria Carlsson had evidently been planning to attend a Saturnalia the day she was murdered. It's impossible to say if the orgies are the link between the victims, but on her calendar, Susanna Kern had circled the same July Saturday that Maria Carlsson had booked for an orgy. Childhood friends Philip Kronstedt and Eugene Kassel are joint owners of the company Kroka Communication Limited, which had a turnover of €95 million last year. Even though they're both registered as living abroad, it's very obvious that they spend most of their time in Sweden. Neither of them has visited the office on Sibylegatan in the past 6 months, and they haven't attended a board meeting in a very long time. The managing director has been in touch with Eugene, most recently just last week, but he hasn't heard from Philip since the start of the year. Linda Barryman said she was still in contact with Maria Carlsson when Philip suddenly withdrew from the Saturnalias. But the orgies went on, attended by both Maria and Eugene. There seem to be a number of regular participants who attend every time, while a limited number of new people are invited along for a trial. According to Linda, Pass cards for the hotel suite double as entrance tickets. The investigative team have little expectation of finding Philip at the hotel, but they're relatively confident that Eugene will be there. According to Maria Carlson's Filofax, there's an orgy planned for next Saturday and another one in 3 weeks' time. These two dates may be their only hope of finding Eugene and tracing Philip. Chapter 37. Adam, Margot, and Una are sitting at a table in the new part of The Doors bar. A football match is playing on the television. Margot is eating a large hamburger and drinking water. Adam and Una are both drinking black coffee.
"Philip doesn't seem to have left Sweden," Adam says, arranging some printouts on the table. "He's here, but he's not registered as living here, and he doesn't appear to have been in any of the homes owned by the company."
Philip Kronstedt's face looks up at them from the table. The photograph shows a man in his 40s with back-combed blonde hair and pale eyebrows. He looks like a friendly, considerate banker. His furrowed brow and the set of his cheeks and chin suggest hard living, but that only makes him look more sympathetic.
"I don't know if I believe that he killed Maria Carlson," Adam adds, pointing a finger at the picture. "It doesn't make sense. I mean, he hasn't got a history of violence. He's got no criminal record. He's never even been suspected of anything. And there's no mention of him in social service records."
"He can afford good lawyers," Margot says.
"Yes, but even so," Adam says.
A woman is dragging a 50-litre barrel of beer across the floor. A family with three young girls walk past the scratched window overlooking Tullegatan.
"All we know is that Philip Kronstedt started to get jealous of Maria," Margot says, and puts some French fries in her mouth. "He wanted her to stop going to the Saturnalias, but she kept going, and now she's dead, and that stud in her tongue is missing."
"Yes, but I'm thinking," she goes on, "I'm thinking that he became obsessed with Maria Carlson, stood on the sidelines, watching her at the orgies. So far, so good. But is he a serial killer?"
"Or a spree killer," Adam says. "We've only got two murders, and that's not actually enough to..."
"But we are hunting a serial killer," she interrupts. "That doesn't really matter," Una says quietly. "But Margot's right, because..." He shuts his eyes as his migraine flares up behind his eye, and he raises his hand slowly to his head. While the pain subsides, he sits absolutely still and tries to remember what he was going to say about spree killers. The term refers to a murderer who has killed at least two people in different places with barely any time between them. A spree killer doesn't have the serial killer's lifelong sexualized attitude towards the dramaturgy of murder, but commits his murders as a direct response to a crisis.
"Okay," Adam says after a while.
"It's still too early to say anything about Philip," Margot says with her mouth full.
"It could be him. I think that's a possibility. But in that case, the orgies form part of his fantasy about killing," Una says, opening his eyes.
"We'll carry on with what we've got," Margot declares. "This evening is the only time we know where Eugene Cassel is going to be, and if anyone can tell us where Philip is, it's Cassel."
"Mind you, we can't just storm into a private orgy," Adam says with a grin.
"Only one of us needs to go in. Find Eugene and talk to him nice and calmly," Margot says, then takes a large bite of her hamburger.
"You can't work out in the field seeing as you're pregnant," Adam says.
"Does it show?" she asks as she chews.
"Okay, what the hell, I'll do it," Adam says.
"This isn't a raid," Margot says. "There's no obvious threat. We'll call it a meeting with an anonymous informant. Then we don't need to run it past management beforehand. Adam sighs and leans back.
So, now I've got to go in among a load of...
He falls silent, stares into space with glazed eyes, and shakes his head.
Obviously, it's a bit tricky, approaching people in a situation like that. But what can we do?
Margot says.
I don't get it. What sort of people would want to go to an orgy?
I don't know. I haven't had group sex for at least 10 years, Margot says, dipping some fries in ketchup.
Adam stares at her, open-mouthed as she chews, a slight smile on her face.
She wipes her fingers on a napkin and then looks up at him.
I was joking, she says, with a grin. I'm a nice girl, I promise. But I was actually involved in a raid on a swingers club when I worked in Helsingborg. As I recall, it was mostly just men in their 60s, with big bellies and skinny legs.
Enough, Adam said, slumping down in his chair.
I'll give your wife a call tomorrow and ask what time you got home, just so you know.
Fine, Adam sighs, then grins.
Think of it as a job, nothing more, Yuna says. The other people are irrelevant. You just go straight in and talk to Eugene. Get him to tell you where Philip is and arrest him as soon as you're sure you've got the information.
Arrest him?
To stop him warning Philip, Yuna says, looking Adam in the eye.
If you find out anything about Philip, Margot says, then we call you, Adam fills in.
No, I'll be asleep, she says, and puts the last of the food in her mouth.
If you find out anything, hand it over to the rapid response unit. The two men remain seated at the table after Margot has left the pub. A few elderly patrons get up from their table and go outside to smoke.
Where are you staying? Adam asks, looking at Yuna.
There's a campsite on the outskirts of Hudinge.
The Roma?
Yuna doesn't reply, takes a sip of coffee and looks out of the window.
I've looked you up, Adam says. I saw that the year before you were injured, you taught the Special Operations Unit in military Krav Maga.
Sorry, but looking at you now, it's hard to believe you were a paratrooper.
Yuna looks at his own hands and thinks what he liked most was jumping from a great height, plummeting down into a terrible storm.
Have you ever been to Leeuwarden? He asks Adam.
Yuna was the only Swede to be sent to the Netherlands to be trained in unconventional close combat and guerrilla warfare. That was at a base north of Leeuwarden. He used to go for long runs along the sandy beaches of the Vaden Sea when the tide had gone out.
Chapter 38. The psychedelic room at the Birger Jarl Hotel that Linda Barryman described is actually known as the Retro Room and can be booked just like any other room. The hotel underwent a complete renovation at the turn of the millennium. All the rooms were gutted and the decor completely changed. Once the workmen had left, it turned out that room 247 had been forgotten. The room had somehow been ignored during every refurbishment since the hotel was built in 1974. It's still intact, like a small time capsule from a bygone age. In 2013, a murder was committed at the hotel after a sofa in room 247 was changed. Naturally, everyone claims that there was no connection between the two events, but now the staff refused to make any adjustments to the layout of the room. Adam has been sitting in his car in front of the old electricity works for 5 hours, watching the entrance to the hotel. Yuna has been standing outside, wrapped in his blanket, holding out a cup with some coins in it. 35 guests have gone in during that time, but no Eugene. Further down the street, a grey-haired waiter is squatting down outside an Italian restaurant, smoking.
When the church bells slowly strike 11 o'clock, Una limps over to the car.
"You'd better go in," he says to Adam.
"Can't you come with me?"
"I'll wait here," Una says.
Adam drums his thumbs on the steering wheel.
"Okay,"
he says, and rubs his chin a few times.
"Take it easy in there," Una says. "Just because they're there doesn't make them criminals. You're likely to see quite a lot of drugs, but ignore that. You should intervene only if you see signs of forced sexual activity, or if there's anyone underage."
Adam nods and feels his stomach flutter as he gets out of the car and walks into the hotel. The softly curved reception desk is empty, except for a man talking on the phone. Adam goes over to the desk, shows his ID, is given a pass card, and continues towards the lifts. The retro room is at the end of the corridor, and on the door handle is a floppy plastic sign saying, "Do not disturb." Adam hesitates, then lowers the zip of his black leather jacket. His white T-shirt is tucked inside his black jeans, and his Sig Sauer is in a holster beneath his left armpit. All he has to do is go in, nice and calmly, he tells himself, find Eugene, take him to one side, and ask his questions. Adam clears his throat and runs the card through the reader. The lock clicks, and a little green light comes on. He opens the door, walks into a dark hallway, and shuts the door behind him. He can hear music and muffled voices and a bed creaking. The light is weak, but it isn't completely dark. He looks around. He's in a small lobby where people have left their clothes. A woman with a boyish blonde haircut comes out of the bathroom and blinks at him in the darkness. She's wearing nothing but a pair of skimpy black silk panties, and she's so beautiful that his heart starts to beat faster. She's got traces of white powder stuck in the lip gloss at one corner of her mouth. She looks at Adam with big black pupils surrounded by a narrow ring of ice blue. She moistens her lips and says something that he doesn't hear before going back into the bedroom. He follows her, unable to stop himself staring at her naked, glistening back. Inside the dimly lit room, there's a sweet, smoky smell. Adam stops and looks over at the bed, then looks away again immediately. He shuffles sideways along the wall, passing a naked man with a glass of champagne in his hand, then stops. No one has reacted to his presence. A woman pushes past, her eyes focused on the floor. The wallpaper is pink and wavy, the carpet brown with a starburst pattern. There are no lamps on, but the light of the city outside reaches around the curtains, spreading across the ceiling. The whole room is heavy with the smell of excited people. Wherever Adam looks, he can see glistening genitals, open mouths, breasts, tongues, buttocks. Apart from the music, there's very little sound. The people having sex are concentrating on that, intent on their own or their partner's pleasure. Others are resting, watching the orgy with a hand between their legs. His pulse thuds in his ears, and he can feel himself blushing. He needs to try to find Eugene. Adam passes a beautiful woman in her 30s. He can't help looking at her. She's wearing a batik blouse and is sitting on the desk with her eyes closed. Her exposed crotch looks like it's been powdered. It resembles polished marble with a line drawn on it in pink chalk. None of it is as desperate or grubby as he had imagined. It's more introverted, more self-aware. Adam carries on round the bed, wondering if this is all simply part of these people's trendy lifestyle. He's the same age as most of the people there, but he's only there to do his job and then go home to his wife in Hirgestern, no doubt to remember what he has seen forever. He knows already that he won't be able to talk to her about it, not seriously. He'll end up joking about it or turning it into something disgusting. He looks at the people around him and thinks that he'll be able to tell himself that they're spoiled, that he feels sorry for them. But that isn't true. Not right then. A pang of envy runs through him. Chapter 39. Adam carries on through the open sliding door to the next room. The wallpaper is darker here, with big, bold patterns like pale green crystals. The music is louder. Two naked men have put an orange plastic armchair on top of the bed. A woman with straight black hair is sitting on the chair, laughing as the others rock the armchair on the mattress. More men join in. Someone grabs hold of her feet and starts to laugh louder. The woman with the boyish haircut is kneeling in front of a glass-topped table, dabbing at the remains of some white powder and rubbing her finger on her gums. He steps aside and almost stands on a large tube of lubricant lying on the floor. Dust and strands of hair have stuck to the goo that's spilled out. In the window are 10 glasses full of champagne. Drops of condensation are running down the stems and forming small puddles on the marble sill. Further into the room, Adam reaches a windowless passageway containing wardrobes and a suitcase rack. The bathroom door is half open. A naked woman is sitting slumped on the lid of the toilet, her stomach folded and one arm tensed. "Are you all right?" Adam asks softly. She lifts her head and looks at him. Her eyes are dark and moist, and he gets a strong feeling that he ought to leave the hotel.
"Help me," she whispers.
"How are you feeling?"
"I can't stand up," she mumbles.
A slim man comes towards them from the bedroom and stops in the doorway. His erect penis sways as he moves.
"Is Paula here?"
he asks. He looks at them through half-closed eyes and then disappears the way he came.
"Help me up," the woman says, breathing through her mouth.
Adam takes her hand and pulls her up onto her feet. He backs away and she stumbles out of the bathroom, managing to pull a towel down from the rail. Only now does he notice that she has a dildo strapped around her hips. She falls towards him and puts her hand round his neck. The woman's breath smells of alcohol, and the dildo slips between his thighs. Her legs begin to give way, and he holds her up, feeling her heavy breasts against his body.
"Can you stand?"
"I don't know if this thing is on right," she mutters against his neck. "Can you check the strap at the back?"
She turns round, leans one hand against the wall, knocking a brown wall clock and making its plastic cover rattle.
"Have you seen Eugene?" Adam asks.
The black leather strap between her buttocks has become twisted, and she feels along it with tired fingers.
"It's twisted," Adam says.
He doesn't know what to do, hesitates, then tries to help her. He twists the strap twice, but notices that it's tangled further down as well. Her skin is hot and sweaty. He's trembling and can feel how cold his fingers are as he follows the strap down between her buttocks. A naked man pushes past and weaves into the bathroom. He urinates without closing the door or so much as glancing at them. Adam can't help noticing that the leather strap between her legs is wet and slippery as he tries to adjust it. She stumbles again and leans her cheek against the wall as the plastic clock sways on its hook. A woman in the next room is whimpering. Two men move through the passageway, and then he sees the beautiful woman with the boyish haircut in the doorway. She's no longer wearing her pants. She's walking slowly towards the next room when she catches sight of him. She raises her champagne glass towards him in a toast, and he sees pale lip prints on the rim. The woman in front of him leans her shoulder against the wall, then slides down onto the floor and rests her cheek on the carpet. The woman with the boyish haircut comes over to Adam. Her neck looks flushed, and she leans into him, pressing her forehead to his chest, then looks up at him with a smile. Adam can't help himself. He kisses her, and she responds, and he can feel her tongue stud against his tongue. He tells himself that he couldn't help it, it's wrong, and he already knows that he's going to regret it and will feel terrible afterwards. But all he wants right now is to have sex with her. The woman on the floor mutters something about falling over and pulls at his leg, making him sway. When the woman with the boyish haircut opens his trousers, a wave of icy fear runs through him. This is too easy, too tempting, he thinks. But his hands are touching her breasts. They're warm and tense and powdered with something rough and glittery. He's never seen such a beautiful woman. He picks her up, pushes her back against the wall, and slides inside. Angst and lust spin through him. He groans and sees her mouth open, and Saturn sparkles on her tongue. Her body billows, and her breasts quiver with his thrusts. She's smiling, eyes closed, but she makes no noise, no groaning, and she doesn't really seem interested in what's happening. Maybe she's too drugged. Two women come into the passageway and watch them for a while before they carry on. The woman with the dildo has got to her feet. She's standing behind him, and her hands are suddenly under his t-shirt, caressing his waist and back. He tries to pull away and doesn't know if she's felt his gun, but she suddenly stops, moves away from him, mutters something, and lurches into the bedroom. Adam knows his cover may have been blown, but he can't stop now. The woman says something to his neck, and he can smell a raspberry aroma from her mouth. She's trying to get him to slow down, puts her hand on his chest, but he moves her hand away and pushes her hard against the wall. Chapter 40. When Adam enters the third room, he immediately catches sight of Eugene Cassell. He's wearing a black top hat, but nothing else. Five people are having sex with each other on the large bed. The shade of a table lamp is hanging askew and shaking in time with the movement of the bed. Eugene is on his knees behind a woman on all fours. Her pearl necklace is swinging between her breasts. The woman with the strap-on dildo comes staggering into the room after Adam. He watches her sit down on the edge of the bed, almost fall, then sit up again. Another woman takes hold of the dildo, says something, and laughs. She replies, then coughs into her elbow. What did you say? Tra-la-la-la, she smiles. Okay. The cops are here, tra-la-la, she repeats, and coughs again. Eugene hears her words and stops, sits down on the bed and puts an arm on the woman's backside, and then turns to look at Adam. This is a private party, he says with a look of disappointment. Is there somewhere we can talk in private? Adam says, showing his police ID. Leave your card, and I'll get my lawyers to call you on Monday, Eugene says, and gets up from the bed. Eugene is about 40 years old, probably the oldest person in the suite of rooms. His naked, hairless body is in good shape despite his protruding stomach. His erection has subsided. Beneath the rim of his hat, a gold ring sparkles in his eyebrow, and his pupils are dilated. I need to find Philip Kronstedt, Adam says. Good luck, Eugene says, and raises his hat slightly. He isn't here, but I can give you a clue. Follow the white rabbit. Listen, Adam says, we can leave the hotel nice and quietly, but if I have to, I'll put handcuffs on you in here and drag you all the way to the car. A woman with shimmering white skin and reddish-brown hair in two plaits over her breasts enters the room and comes over to Eugene.
"Shall I order some food?" she says, putting a joint to her lips.
"Still hungry?"
he asks flirtatiously. She nods and smiles, then exhales a narrow plume of smoke and walks off towards the phone beside the bed.
"Okay, I'm going to have to arrest you according to Chapter 24, Paragraph 7 of the Penal Code," Adam says. "It's not my fault you went to a bad school and ended up having to join the police," Eugene says sternly. "The world's unfair, and you know Maria Carlson, don't you?" Adam butts in.
"I love her," he replies slowly.
"Give her a kiss," Adam says, pulling out a picture from the crime scene. In the sharp light of the flash, the dead woman's ravaged face, gaping mouth, and broken jaw are brutally visible. Eugene whimpers, staggers backwards, and knocks over a table lamp, and its brown ceramic base shatters.
Chapter 41. Eugene Cassell has put his clothes back on, and Adam has called for a patrol car. They're walking down the hotel corridor together.
"I'm really sorry. I'm shocked. Just tell me what I can do. I want to help, as a point of honor, but I have to speak to my lawyer first."
Eugene has washed his face, but his cheeks are white and shiny with sweat.
"I need to find Philip," Adam says.
"He didn't do this," Eugene says instantly.
"Philip isn't at any of the usual addresses. Where is he?"
"I know he's not doing too well," Eugene says, scratching his forehead with his hat. "Look, I'm not going to spread shit about Philip, but the way things are right now, I really don't want anything to do with him. I've tried to get him to seek help, but help with what?" Adam says.
The lift door opens and they step aside to let a woman in an orange trench coat get out before going in.
"He's been taking a bit too much,"
Eugene smiles, waving his hand towards his temple.
"Is he an addict?"
"Yes, but the problem with taking too much MDPV, MDPPP, MDPBP, MDAI, it doesn't work. You just get fucking paranoid, and then you get the wrong sort of high and end up feeling so bad you want to die."
"Does it make you aggressive?"
Adam asks as they step out of the lift on the ground floor.
"I mean, you're terrified the whole time, but sort of ultra-focused at the same time. You think too quickly, don't sleep at all. The last time I met Philip, he was completely fucking manic. Said he was on thousands of satellite pictures on Google. Kept going on about Saturn being forced to eat his own children. He couldn't stand still for a second. He kept ranting, waving this little knife around. He cut my hand and yelled that I should be grateful. And then he cut himself right across the arm. He was dripping with blood as he ran off into the underground."
They pass the lobby and walk out of the doors onto Tulegatan at the very moment a patrol car pulls up.
"Right now, I just need to know where I can find him," Adam repeats, stopping Eugene.
"Okay. I feel like a traitor, but he said they couldn't see him in the storerooms."
"Storerooms?"
"He rents a load of storage over on Vanadisvegen. You know, that self-storage place. I think he's got more than half of the storerooms there."
Two uniformed officers come over and say hello to Adam. One of them leads Eugene to the back seat of the car while the other one listens to Adam.
"Take him to the custody negotiation room," says Adam. "Make sure he doesn't call anyone. Buy us some time. Once his lawyer shows up, we won't be able to hold him."
Chapter 42. Yuna is driving fast as he ignores the red light and turns left into Udengatan. A homeless woman with two overloaded shopping trolleys is sitting asleep outside the 7-Eleven. Adam tells him how Philip has been overdosing on several different varieties of MDPV for a while now, and that Eugene thinks he's entered a paranoid psychosis. The drug has caused a number of deaths in Sweden and was referred to in the evening tabloids as the cannibal drug, after a man who'd taken it tried to eat the face of a homeless man.
"We haven't got much time. They won't be able to hold Eugene for long. He'll be out soon, and I reckon he's likely to warn Philip," Adam says in a tense voice.
Yuna overtakes a taxi on the inside, pulls in front of it, then swerves into the oncoming lanes and turns into Vanadisvägen. The bumper thuds as he drives up onto the pavement and stops in front of the pale mocha-coloured building with red garage doors. Within central Stockholm, the self-storage companies have had to make do with using existing basements so as not to change the visible appearance of the city. Huge areas of small, locked rooms spread out just below the ground, like old catacombs beneath cathedrals. Yuna and Adam get out of the car and head over to the closed office looking out onto the little car park. In the gloom, through the window, they can make out flat stacks of removal boxes, a reception desk, and a large monitor for security cameras on the wall.
"I want to look at a map of the storerooms, and I want to look at those cameras," Yuna says.
"It's closed. We're going to have to go through a prosecutor," Adam replies.
Yuna nods, taps his stick against the edge of the pavement, and thinks how it feels to sink through broken ice. "It's when you warm up that you start to freeze," he thinks, as he picks up a heavy curbstone and throws it through the window. There's a loud crash as the glass shatters and a red light begins to flash over on the reception desk.
"The alarm will have gone off at their security company," Adam says feebly.
Yuna pushes some loose splinters from the window frame with his stick, then goes in. Adam looks round, then follows him. There's a plan hanging on the wall showing a grid system of wide and narrow passageways. Every storeroom is numbered and they're arranged in blocks. A list of staff codes for the stores is neatly pinned up alongside. Yuna sits down at the computer. The passageways between the storerooms are monitored by security cameras. 25 small squares cover the screen. All the cameras are filming windowless darkness. It's night, and the lights have all been switched off.
"See if you can find a list of customers," Adam says.
Yuna minimizes the security cameras, tries to open various programs, but can't get anywhere. Everything, apart from the cameras, requires a password. He quickly returns to the cameras and enlarges the first square and stares at the grey-black stillness, like a black square of linen. Then the next one. The camera is filming nothing but darkness. Adam shuffles nervously behind him. He looks at the plan on the wall. Everything is quiet, sunk in darkness. The third camera is pointed towards an emergency exit. A green sign above the door casts an algae-like glow across the flecked cement floor and corrugated metal walls. There's some rubbish outside one of the storerooms, and the underwater lighting from the emergency exit illuminates an abandoned barrow. Yuna glances at the plan on the wall and locates the emergency exit and works out where the camera is mounted. Everything is still quiet. A numbing feeling of exhaustion washes over him like a wave, forcing him to close his eyes for a couple of seconds. The darkness on the computer screen is monotonous. Some of the cameras register light from coded locks, but nothing else.
"Dark," Adam says.
"Yes," Yuna says, enlarging the 14th square. He's just about to close it when there's a flicker in the bottom corner.
"Hang on," he says.
Adam leans forward and looks at the dark image. There's nothing in sight. Everything is still. But then the little light in the corner flashes again.
What was that?
Adam whispers, leaning closer to the screen. The little light flashes again. It's faint and only manages to light up a small area of floor, revealing the pattern of the cement. Yuna clicks to enlarge the next camera image, then the next, and waits a while, but they show nothing but blackness. He looks at the overview with all 25 cameras at the same time. Number 14 flickers again, but the others remain lifeless.
The source of the light ought to be here or here, Yuna says, pointing at the plan. But it's not covered by one single camera, which makes no sense.
Where are we? Adam asks, looking at the plan on the wall.
Camera 14 must be at the far end of Corridor C, Yuna says. He enlarges the images one by one, all black, still, but suddenly he stops.
Did you see something? Adam asks.
They both stare at the static black image. That's what I mean, Yuna replies. Where's the green light? This is the camera pointing at the emergency exit.
Try that one, Adam says, pointing. That ought to pick up the light from the lock leading to the next section.
Yuna quickly enlarges the image, also completely black. The door and lock can't be seen at all. That can only be because there's something wrong with the camera. There seem to be an awful lot of faulty cameras down there.
There's a huge area missing. Loads of cameras, he says, looking at Adam.
Where?
The whole of this upper area, along corridors C, D, and E. That's maybe 50 storerooms, Yuna says, looking back at the image from camera 14 again.
The faint light flickers across the uneven floor and remains on for a moment. He can just make out the bottom of the metal doors before the light goes off, then comes on again.
That light's an emergency signal, Yuna says, getting up from the chair.
Security camera number 14 is registering fragments of an emergency signal. Further along the corridor, where the cameras aren't working, someone is flashing a light. It's the international emergency signal using Morse code. SOS. Three quick flashes, followed by three longer ones, then three short ones again.
Chapter 43.
The automatic garage door whirs shut behind them. The pain in his hip from walking down the slope makes Yuna break out in a sweat. His heavy pistol is swinging against his ribs, and the sound of his stick echoes in the narrow tunnel leading down to the storage area.
We ought to call for backup, Adam says, drawing his Sig Sauer.
He pulls out the magazine, checks that it's full, pushes it back in, and feeds the first bullet into the chamber.
There's no time, but I can go in on my own, Yuna says.
I was thinking of telling you to wait outside. You're not a police officer anymore, and I can't take responsibility for you, Adam explains.
They emerge into an underground garage with metal doors leading to the storage area. Large ventilation pipes run across the ceiling.
I can usually manage, Yuna says, stopping in front of the door.
He pulls out his large caliber pistol. It's a Colt Combat with new sights and an improved trigger coil. He's filed one side of the rosewood grip so that the gun sits snugly in his left hand. Adam walks over to the keypad to the coded lock and pulls out the list of staff codes. The little screen casts a blue light over his hand and up across the white concrete wall.
Stay behind me,
he whispers and opens the door. They go inside, closing the steel door carefully behind them, and start to head along a dark side passage. The monotonous grey metal walls and series of storeroom doors stretch off into the darkness. They're approaching the first wider passageway, which, according to the plan, runs the entire length of the basement.
They move across the cement floor, almost silently. The only sound is from Adam's breathing and the faint tapping of Yuna's stick. Adam is walking ahead and slows down when he reaches the junction with the main passageway. His right shoulder rubs against the metal wall. He stops, then swings round the corner quickly with his pistol raised. There's a buzzing sound as the ceiling lights come on 10 meters away. It sounds like a large parrot climbing the bars of its cage. Adam lowers his gun and tries to breathe through his nose. The barrel of his pistol is moving slightly in time with his raised pulse. The sudden light makes Yuna's migraine flare behind his eye. It's not serious, but he still has to lean against the wall for a moment before following Adam. The lights in the main passageways are evidently activated by motion sensors. Yuna looks up at one of the security cameras. The dark lens shimmers enigmatically. The pipes running across the ceiling click. But otherwise, the basement is completely quiet. They reach a side passage, and once again there's a clatter of tiny claws as a section of lighting comes on in the main walkway. They turn left, walking past rows of sealed storerooms and past two shabby sofas as the lights go out behind them.
"We ought to reach his area soon," Adam whispers.
Indirect light from an electronic lock some way ahead makes the storeroom seem to bulge out into the passageway. Adam pauses to listen. There's a drumming, rattling sound somewhere. They can both hear something hard knocking against metal. Then everything falls silent again. They wait several seconds before continuing to move forward into the darkness. There's a sudden scraping sound, then a metallic noise far in the distance. Yuna points up at a camera in the ceiling. The lens has been covered with duct tape. Adam stops before he reaches the next main passageway, moves his pistol to his left hand, wipes his right palm on his trousers, gives his hand a shake, then takes a firm grip of his gun. He notices that some gold glitter from the woman in the hotel room has stuck to the sleeve of his jacket and glances quickly at Yuna, focuses, and darts round the corner. The ceiling clicks and ticks along the passageway as the lights come on in quick succession. The walls, floor, and ceiling are bathed in sharp light, but beyond the lights there's nothing but blackness. Even though the passageway runs another 50 meters or so, only the first 10 are visible. "Stop," Yuna says quietly behind Adam. They both stand completely still in the illuminated passageway. A drop of sweat falls from the tip of Adam's nose. Yuna leans on his stick, feeling strangely dizzy. The brittle knocking sound starts up again in the distance, a high-frequency metallic buzz. Suddenly, the lights in the main passageway go out when the sensors can't detect any movement. The two men stand motionless, staring into the darkness. Up ahead, there's a faint glow across the floor from one of the side passages. The light vanishes, then returns in the same sequence, 3 longer flashes, followed by 3 short ones. The strange drumming sound echoes again, followed by something hitting a metal wall. It's much closer now.
"What do we do?"
Adam whispers. Yuna doesn't have time to answer before the ceiling lights at the very far end of the main passageway come on. A young woman is standing in the middle of the gangway, swaying. She's wearing nothing but a pair of dirty tracksuit bottoms and a padded jacket. Her feet are bare and her hair looks matted. She's tied round the waist with thick steel wire, which snakes off into the side passage next to her. When she takes a step forward, the wire makes a metallic rattling sound against the walls behind her. Her right arm is moving strangely, twitching, and then moving away from her. There's a black band round her wrist. It looks like someone's tugging the band. She steps towards them. Her arm sinks, and suddenly there's a large shadow behind her. A huge dog with a bloody ear appears at her side. Its black leash hangs limp in her hand and leads behind her back and up to the dog's neck. The huge dog is a Great Dane. It reaches her chest and must weigh twice as much as her. The dog moves nervously, twitching its head anxiously. The woman says something and then drops the leash on the ground. The dog leaps forward and picks up speed rapidly in the passageway. The huge animal is getting closer to Yuna and Adam with powerful, silent movements. Its muscles ripple across its back and loins as the lights come on, section by section. They move back and raise their guns just as the lights go off at the far end of the passageway. The young woman is no longer visible. The sound of the animal's claws and its panting breath is getting louder. They run into a side passage, past padlocks that shimmer in the light from the main passageway. But 15 meters in, their way is blocked by a barricade of furniture and removal boxes. Now they can hear barking from another direction. A sharp pain flares behind one of Yuna's eyes. It's as if a hot knife blade is being pushed into his head. And when it gets pulled out again, he can't see for a few seconds. The pain of his migraine almost makes him drop his gun. The dog slides on the cement floor, comes round the corner, catches sight of him, and speeds up again. Yuna raises his pistol, blinks hard in an effort to see properly, but the sight on the barrel is trembling too much. It's too dark, but he fires anyway. The sound of the shot multiplies off the metal walls and concrete. The bullet misses and ricochets between the walls. The dog is approaching with powerful bounds. Yuna blinks and can just make it out in a series of flickering images, its pointed ears and shimmering muscles, shoulders and strong thighs. His stick clatters to the floor as he rests his shoulder against the corrugated metal of a storeroom door and takes aim again. "Yuna!" Adam cries. The sights quiver and slip past the beast's head. He squeezes the trigger. The sights slide down towards its dark torso, and the shot rings out as the bullet slams into the dog's chest just beneath its throat. The recoil sends Yuna staggering backwards. He tries to keep his balance and throws his arm out, hitting the corrugated metal with the barrel of the pistol. The dog's legs buckle, its heavy body thuds to the floor, momentum carrying it forward. It slides across the cement floor and hits Yuna's legs. He sinks to one knee and lets out a gasp. His vision flares and jagged shapes flash and pulse in front of his eyes. The dog's legs are still twitching as Yuna gets to his feet and picks up his stick. Some distance away, Adam is clambering over the barricade of old furniture, rolled-up carpets and boxes. He gets tangled up in a bicycle and falls over the other side, hitting his head against a metal door. In front of Yuna is an upturned bed pushed against one wall. He shoves it over, across the rest of the barricade, and squeezes through the gap between it and the wall. Through piles of chairs, bags of clothes hangers, and old-fashioned hair dryers on stands, he sees Adam get to his feet just as the second dog launches itself at him. Chapter 44. Adam cries out in pain as Yuna pushes through the gap between the bed and the storeroom wall. He hears something made of glass break under the pressure. The lights in the main passageway go out, but Yuna can still see that the huge dog has clamped its jaws round Adam's lower arm. It's pulling backwards hard, snarling as its claws scrabble on the cement floor. Adam is gasping and trying to hit the animal. Yuna can't fire into the darkness, so he tries to force his way through to them. A standard lamp with a broken shade tucked into a pile of chairs catches on his clothes. The dog isn't letting go of Adam's arm. They crash into the metal wall together. Blood from Adam's arm is running from its locked jaws. Its paws slip on the polished cement floor, its claws unable to get any grip. The dog jerks backwards again, trying to knock Adam off balance, but he's managing to stay on his feet. Yuna shoves the lamp aside. Its cord whips his cheek, but he makes it out past the bed and clambers over some boxes of books. The dog makes a sudden downward jerk, and when Adam stumbles forward, it lets go and snaps at his neck. It misses and only catches part of the collar of his jacket, rips the fabric, and tries to bite again. Adam throws himself back, falls, and starts to kick out. The dog bites into his foot and tugs him towards it. Yuna pulls over a box of paperback books as he stumbles out onto the floor. He runs over with his pistol raised, but the dog suddenly lets go and disappears.
"Big dogs," Yuna says.
Leaning on his stick, he watches as Adam picks his pistol up off the floor and gets to his feet. Yuna shuts his weary eyes for a moment and can't help thinking that he might be about to break. They carry on towards the next main passageway. The lights go on ahead of them, and the clicking sound is back. "There," Adam says. They catch a glimpse of someone disappearing into one of the side passages. There's a sound of clattering metal wire vibrating against the metal walls.
"Did you see? Was it the same woman?"
"I don't think so,"
Yuna replies, noticing how pale and sweaty Adam's face is.
"How are you doing?"
Adam doesn't answer, just shakes off the blood running down the back of his hand onto the floor. His lower arm is injured, but his leather jacket prevented it being completely torn apart. They stick to the right-hand side of the passageway in order to be able to see into the side passage on the left. The metal wire scrapes and rattles against the metal walls. A young woman is standing in the passageway, swaying. It's not the same one as before. Her white jeans and checkered shirt are much dirtier.
"He said you'd come,"
she mumbles in a brittle voice.
"We're police officers," Adam says.
She staggers and fumbles for a little dog whistle attached to a cord around her neck.
"Don't do it,"
Adam says, when he sees the second large dog get closer, crouching low with its ears folded down. She's been crying. Her makeup has run down her face and her hair is hanging in messy clumps. There's blood around the waist of her shirt. She rolls the dog whistle between her fingers, then puts it to her lips. Adam raises his